accessibility.
I'm going to call this meeting of the Government Operations Committee to order. Let the record reflect that there is a quorum. The first item on the agenda is approval of the minutes for the Valentine's Day meeting of the Government Operations Committee. Do I have a motion to approve those?
Would think they would want us.
So moved.
Representative Nelson moves approval of the minutes. Is there any discussion? Okay, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The minutes are approved.
I'm on here.
Okay, there have been, just wanted to draw your attention in your packet, there's a February 15th referral memo outlining several bills that were referred to the elections subcommittee, so just wanted to make sure you were aware of those. I'll let you read that at your leisure. Is Representative Moeller here? Okay. Somebody want to, you want to go grab her? Talk amongst yourselves.
No, it was online, but they were coming in and I might pack it.
Okay. I understand the memo is not in the packet. Maybe it was actually just intended for me, so I'll just let you know. So I apologize for that. I'll just let you know that House Files 1098, 1123, 1147, 1152, 1153, and 1183 were referred to the Subcommittee on Elections. It is posted on the committee website as well. I see Representative Moeller here. Yeah, it's always emailed out to everyone as well. So welcome to the Government Operations Committee, Representative Moeller. Oh, you didn't have to do that. So Representative Moeller bought treats. That's very nice of her.
Yes.
I've been actually trying to change the culture around the expectation that freshman members do that. So, but apparently Representative Moeller did not get the memo, but I will not hold that against you. In fact, I think most of the committee members will hold that in favor of you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yes, thank you for being here. So I will move that House File 418 be re-referred to the Public Safety Committee. I believe that was where this is going. Okay. Thank you. Representative Moeller, if you could please present your bill.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. There is a delete everything amendment.
Sure. Thank you for that reminder. I will move the amendment to House File 418. The amendment is coded DE4. Is this just to put the bill in the shape you would like it, Representative Moeller?
That's correct, Mr. Chair.
Okay, yes. So I will move the amendment. Is there any discussion? Okay, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The amendment is adopted. The bill is in the shape you would like. If you could please present your bill as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. So House File 418 is, the purpose of this bill is to create a working group to look at rewriting the criminal sexual conduct statutes. And this is something that the Minnesota Coalition Against Sexual Assault supports, and you'll be hearing from them. But it's also something that I support as a prosecutor in my other job. And as many of you legislators are aware, it seems like every year we are finding more and more gaps in the criminal sexual conduct code, and we have to come to the legislature to close those gaps, whether that's the marital rape exception, whether that's some issues with position of authority. We actually have cases that we, as prosecutors, want to prosecute, and we find that our statutes don't allow us to do that. And so really, the Denied Justice series that the Star Tribune did highlighted also some additional gaps in the prosecution, the investigation, the prosecution of these cases. And what we'd like to do is take a comprehensive look at the criminal sexual conduct statutes and figure out a way to write them better so that we have justice for victims and so we're holding offenders accountable. And I just want to give one brief example. I have a number of testifiers, but in the sexual abuse cases I've worked on, when cases involve children, I have watched numerous videos of children doing their interview with the forensic examiners, and we ask our children to describe in great detail every single aspect of the assault. Was there penetration or was there contact? And children don't have the capacity to understand what happened to them, let alone to answer some of these questions. But the way our statutes are written requires us to really delve into some of these really specific details that, in my mind, no matter whether there's contact or penetration of a child, it's all bad. And so we really want to, you know, look at that and figure out, is that necessary for us to go into to those details? On those cases, but in a wide range of other sexual assault cases. So with that, Mr. Chair, I would like to call my first testifier.
Before you do, I understand we have a question from Representative Quam. Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And in the past, Representative Pinto, I and others have worked on bills for, you know, against sex trafficking, people trafficking, you know, law enforcement pretending to be a different age. And what consistently popped up were a judge would find some issue. Would it be, I just think retired judges might be a great advisory group because they could think of maybe obscure things that might pop up because that it's sort of frustrating. You know, we pass legislation, and we think we, you know, have it really good, and then an exception pops up. So just a suggestion.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Mueller.
Yeah, Mr. Chair and Representative Quam, yes, thank you for that. And actually, one of the child abuse cases that I was talking about, there was a Supreme Court case that just came out in December that reversed a first-degree conviction based on how the language was written and how I don't think that that was the intent of this legislature when it wrote it. And I have a separate bill meaning to address that. So I think prosecutors can offer that, but also if you look at who we have invited to be part of the working group, we have included the judicial branch in that, which is an important voice.
Okay. Thank you. And I'm going to amend my motion. I understand there is an appropriation in this bill, so the proper motion would be for it to go to Ways and Means and not Public Safety. So I'll just revise that. And so we have a few testifiers. If you could please approach. And so are there four people, it looks like?
Yeah, that's correct.
Okay, so if you could try to keep your testimony to 2 or 3 minutes, we would appreciate it. We have a couple other bills today.
Absolutely. My name's Lindsay Bryce. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I appreciate being invited to be here today. I'm the Law and Policy Director for the Minnesota Coalition Against Sexual Assault, and I've worked with and for survivors of gender-based violence for over 20 years. The Minnesota Coalition Against Sexual Assault, I don't know if we've been in front of this particular committee. I know we haven't this year, but the Minnesota Coalition Against Sexual Assault is a statewide program. We provide leadership and resources for sexual assault programs and allies to prevent sexual violence while promoting a comprehensive, socially just response for all victims and survivors. We're a coalition of approximately 75 different member programs, allies, and survivors. I'm here to speak in favor and in support of this file, and I thank Representative Mueller and others for bringing this forward today. Our work, our policy work, is informed by our member programs, our allies, criminal justice system professionals, survivors, and many others. We actually have significant prosecutor involvement in our policy work, and I'm a former prosecutor myself as well. And we've spent, Representative Mueller is right, we've spent years, every year it feels like, I haven't been at MnCASA for a long time as an employee, but I've been involved with MnCASA for a long time, and it feels like every year we come to the legislature and say, well, this piece needs to get fixed, and this piece is a problem. And what we want to do is create a comprehensive fix to all of these problems, or as many of these problems as we possibly can. For example, last year we received a strong message from advocacy programs that they were seeing substantial problems with the prosecution or lack thereof of alcohol-related sexual assault and substance-related sexual assault cases. So we started looking at the definitions of mental incapacitation and physically helpless. I spent a number of hours talking to advocacy. I spent Well, and we spent one meeting, we spent 3 hours with a bunch of attorneys and prosecutors mostly in a room trying to figure out how do we fix this. And everything, what we kept coming to is there's so many things in the statute that have been added to and sort of piecemeal fixes that have happened over the years that an actual comprehensive fix is to do a working group like this. It is not to do this piecemeal work. There are subdivisions that are internally inconsistent, but they're also very intertwined. And so we support this comprehensive work being done within a multidisciplinary group that includes a very intentional focus on meaningful input from survivors and victims and marginalized communities that may not otherwise have their voices heard in this. This is a priority on our agenda, and I believe that everybody here has received a copy of our agenda, so you'll see that this is also a priority for us in 2019. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Ms. Bryce. Could the next testifier come forward, please?
Good morning, Mr. Chair. My name is Megan Adiola. I'm 25 years old. I'm a lawyer. I'm a House of Representatives employee. And I'm here because I'm a survivor of rape and domestic violence. I am here in support of this bill because I spend 50-plus hours per week running an online support group for survivors of sexual violence across the United States and internationally. I speak to high schoolers about healthy relationships, healthy sexuality, and consent, and I do this mostly at private Catholic high schools. I do this all unpaid on top of my full-time job here because I feel like it's my calling to provide the information, the resources, and the support that was lacking when I was coming to terms with the aftermath of my rape. I was assaulted when I was 17 by a boyfriend. I spent 2 years being repeatedly coerced into unwanted sexual encounters, and I experienced at least one instance of forcible rape. When I got to law school and began studying criminal law, it broke my heart to learn that even though the statute of limitations on my assault had not yet expired, the rape I experienced would likely not be prosecutable under the current definitions of rape, sodomy, assault, and consent currently on the books. I knew reporting would be fruitless. Our current societal understanding of what a rape victim looks like, who a rapist can be, and how a survivor of sexual trauma behaves in the aftermath mean that so many survivors simply can't bear the re-traumatization that comes with reporting their assault. I was unable to receive systemic justice, but I received justice in other ways by doing stuff like this, by speaking out, telling my story, and providing support to those who need it. But for many survivors, especially Minnesotan survivors, that's not enough. They need to know that if they have the courage to report, law enforcement and our court systems will work to seek justice as much as they can. If I had reported when I was 17 and my assault occurred, my work has taught me how I would have been received. I know the questions that would have been asked of me and the factors that were working against me. I was dating my perpetrator. I had consented to vaginal intercourse before he forcibly and unwantedly sodomized me, and I stayed in the relationship for a year after he raped me. I would have been met with questions like, how did he know you didn't really want it? Why didn't you scream or hit him? Why were you letting him undress you? You stayed with him. That proves you must not have been hurt that badly. I was hurt. I still hurt to this day, but that wouldn't have been enough for a commonly untrained law enforcement officer to understand. And I'm not guessing when I present these questions as a hypothetical in my situation. These are the realities that survivors who report face every single day to this day by unwanted law enforcement and criminal justice representatives. I hear stories every day, multiple times a day, from victims having to struggle with the trauma that is amplified when these questions are hurled at them in their most vulnerable state. When I say I hear these stories every day, I mean it. I hear from hundreds of survivors daily in our group. Every time I think I've heard it all, some new way that a person has been sexually violated comes across my screen. So many of these traumas cannot be prosecuted for a number of reasons. Police departments across the country and across the globe are simply lacking the knowledge about how trauma affects a person who's been sexually assaulted, who commits sexual violence, and who can be a victim of sexual violence. How a victim survivor's story is received by their reporting officer can determine whether a victim proceeds forwards with charges against their attacker. I don't blame individual police officers. I don't blame individual judges or individual lawyers. These questions hurt to hear every single time they're asked, but they reflect societal misconceptions about sexual trauma and violence that are pervasive in our system. I'm not so blinded by my passion for this subject that I don't recognize that sometimes all crimes are not prosecutable. No matter the type of crime, sometimes the facts, the evidence, and the investigation just don't provide enough to support a criminal charge. But what law enforcement agencies and prosecutors can do is to strive to not re-traumatize the victims when they're brave enough to report. Just because a case does not move forward in the courts does not mean that a victim is lying. Then they should be treated as such. It costs exactly $0 to treat a trauma survivor with respect, so I hope that's reflected in this bill's fiscal note. That was a joke. As you heard from the experts on this subject, and I hope you read in the Star Tribune Denied Justice series, the statistics don't lie. There's a fundamental misunderstanding about sexual violence that has been allowed to overtake our criminal justice system for too long, and we need change. I believe that under the dutiful advice of groups like MnCASA, MCBW, and RISE, and other advocacy groups that are in support of this bill, this working group can do some concrete good. Putting together in one place representatives of all different types of groups where a victim survivor may seek help will be a meeting of the minds unlike any that Minnesota has ever seen. This exchange of information, expertise, and stories like mine cannot be undervalued. Working groups like this one will put Minnesota on the forefront of a national call for reform around sexual violence laws. We can lead the way to be an example of respect, belief, and equal justice under the law for other states hoping to follow suit. I'm not an expert in this field. I'm not a certified professional, a stakeholder, an executive, or an elected official. I'm just a survivor, speaking out of love for the survivors I support every single day. And I ask you to consider the good that this working group will do for Minnesota survivors today and for generations to come. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you for your testimony, Ms. Arriola. If the next testifier could come down, please. If you could keep your testimony to about 2 minutes, that would be great. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Keila Marie Granda. I am the founding and executive director of Unspoken Voices, a nonprofit that works to advocate for survivors. And that's done through a variety of means. But in this case, it's done through sharing their voices. Today, I represent not just myself, but the many, many survivors that I know are across the state that I have worked with and that have come forward bravely and said, I was assaulted. And for those who maybe aren't able to do so, I am trying to use my voice to be able to help each of these individuals. Everything I really wanted to say has been covered in a way, so I just want to share a short story with you. Prior to being the founding and executive director of the nonprofit I'm with, I was the Violence Prevention and Response Program Coordinator for the University of Minnesota Morris. I was also an advocate. My master's is in criminal justice. I have a background in advocacy, and I have a background in these types of fields. As working in that position with the university, I had to serve as an advocate for quite a few individuals who had been sexually assaulted. And I repeatedly saw the systemic failure that took place when these individuals were re-traumatized through the court process, or perhaps didn't even get to the court process. Maybe only through law enforcement. Maybe they got it to the prosecutor and no further. And I saw this continually happen. And I was frustrated, but I didn't know what to do about it. However, I still believed in the system. And that was until in late 2013, I was raped, brutally raped by a colleague of mine. You know what? I chose to believe in the system because that was my job. I worked inside the system. That was what I did. So I chose to believe. I chose to report. I chose to do it all right. I did everything right. And yet, no justice was served. No justice. And I'm not the only one. I speak for thousands of us in this state alone that say we did not receive justice. And it's bills like this, it's legislation like this that is going to make that change. So that at the end of the day, we as survivors feel like we haven't had our power stripped away yet again by the system. For me, I was raped by an individual, and then I felt that I was raped again by what the system did to me, even when I thought I did everything that I possibly could, and I fought, and I screamed, and I did everything I could, but it didn't make a bit of difference. Less than 1 in 100 cases of sexual assault are actually prosecuted successfully, and we need to change those numbers. Things like this will change that number. So I urge you from the bottom of my heart and on behalf of other survivors to please, please consider pushing this forward. Consider however you can supporting it. as survivors, we thank you because you are the ones who can make the change for us. And we rest in your hands. So thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Please come forward and identify yourself.
Thank you. My name is Sarah Stengel, and I'm a visual artist, a mid-career visual artist, represented in more than 260 public collections. Between the ages of 4 years and 8 months and 5 years and 9 months, I was ritually tortured by three older children. And the torture was something that I became complicit in because they gave me very specific instructions and that if I didn't follow them, the threat was that my skull would be bashed in with the baseball bat and my body would be tossed into the Lehigh River under the New Street Bridge. And they were convincing because they were violent. Part of the torture involved witnessing them beat up my friend who I walked to school with, whose name was Tommy, and part of it consisted of two of them holding me down while the other person did things to me. And much of it was blocked. Then the instructions were accompanied by directions about what I should wear. I should never wear shorts. I should never wear a skirt because they didn't want anyone to see the bruises on my legs. And they were also, and I might be repeating myself here, but it is a key point. If I told anybody, they were going to kill me. The result of these repeated threats was that I stopped talking altogether for a period of 7 years. So I felt safe at home. I would speak at home, but I didn't speak in school. I ate lunch alone. I didn't have friends. In fact, no one would talk to me. Not only would no one talk to me, but the fact that I was selectively mute made me a target for other bullies because they realized that I wouldn't tell anyone. So this cycle was broken because I had loving parents, because they got me martial arts, because they changed me to a safer environment. And, you know, at this point, I have a very good life. But one of the lasting impacts of that torture was that I do not feel my body normally from the waist down. My disassociation was so profound. And that has had health impact. I can tell you with certainty that if I was placed at any age between the age of 5 and maybe 25 in a room of police officers, older men, even well-intentioned counselors, I would not probably have said a peep until my perps were in jail. When I started talking about it was when Bobby Cox was put away on his 18th count of aggravated assault and 5th count of rape. He was put away for life, and Peachy was put in a home for the emotionally disturbed. And at that point, when I knew that they were incarcerated, I started to find my voice. So the idea that young children can meaningfully testify in the face of this kind of trauma that separates the mind from the body is just not a realistic. Concept. Thank you. Thank you very much for listening.
Thank you for your testimony, Ms. Stengel. Is there anybody else who would like to testify on this bill? Okay. Seeing none, I will close this public testimony. Is there any member discussion? Representative Tice.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative, I'm just concerned that there isn't a Senate companion. Are you working on getting a companion so that we can possibly see this go forward?
Representative Mueller?
Mr. Chair, Representative Tice, yes, I was actually talking with someone yesterday, and I'm not sure if he's going to author the bill or not, but I am working on, very much so working on getting a Senate companion to this.
Thank you. Representative Tice. Okay. Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to the author. New members and the public listening, there are many reasons why we do bills, and this is a great example of a couple of them. One is the most obvious, to improve or correct the law. But two, it's to allow people to come forward and give testimony. For us as members and for the public in general, to listen and gain understanding that we maybe had lacked before. And so you know, whether there was a Senate companion bill or not, there is value to us in this discussion, but I do believe the bill will go forward. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Quam. Is there any additional member comments or questions? Okay, seeing none, I will renew the motion that House File 418 as amended be referred to the Ways and Means Committee. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The motion carries. Your bill is on its way. Thank you for coming.
Thank you.
Thank you for the treats, Representative Mueller.
Thank you.
So the next bill on the agenda is actually mine. I'm going to hand the gavel over to Vice Chair Sauk. And if you could just give me one moment, I will get my materials and be over there.
Thank you. Representative Freiberg, go ahead and introduce your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I will move that House File 1026 be referred to the Committee on Education Policy. So this bill relates to a couple entities that are both within the jurisdiction of the Government Operations Committee. They were created a few years ago. It's the School Safety Technical Assistance Center and the School Safety Technical Assistance Council. When they were created, they were both scheduled to sunset this year. So this bill would just remove the sunset provision and allow them to continue operating. They've both been doing very important work, and have some testifiers here who can speak to that in a little bit more detail. The School Safety Technical Assistance Center, is located at the Department of Education, and I understand they're here as well. And the goal is to help districts and schools provide a safe and supportive learning environment, foster academic achievement for all students by focusing on prevention, intervention, support, and recovery efforts to develop and maintain safe and supportive schools. The council, the School Safety Technical Assistance Council, has 23 members who work to improve school climate and safety. Their duties include establishing norms and standards around issues of prohibited conduct, advancing evidence-based policy and best practices to improve the school climate and promote school safety, developing and disseminating resources and training, and developing policies and procedures for services provided by the School Climate Center. So those are the two entities the bill relates to. I know I have a couple... at least one testifier here. I know Kat from out front, Minnesota, is here. And I think Charlene is here, too. If you'd just like to say a few words.
Welcome.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. Good morning, members. I'm Charlene Briner. I'm the Deputy Commissioner at the Minnesota Department of Education, and I'm here to speak on behalf of the bill in front of you. The School Safety and Technical Assistance Center really is integral to the department's role to provide safe, welcoming, and supportive schools in order to help children achieve their academic and full potential. We all know that if children do not feel safe and supportive in schools, that it is very difficult for them to meet their academic goals and to be successful. We provide a number of services and supports to schools across the state. I have a couple of just high-level talking points, and of course we can provide you deeper information. But since the center was established in 2014, we field hundreds of calls every year. The first year that the center was in operation, we fielded more than 700 calls from students, parents, and educators looking for support and resources. That has tapered off, but we still field between 250 and 350 calls each year. We provide, on average, each year 500 hours of training to 4,000 educators across the state. We conduct approximately, it's kind of averaged, five investigations. So if we get a complaint about bullying in school and the complaint is related to the lack of a district or a school having a policy as required by law. We conduct an investigation. We don't have authority to require any corrective action, but we do in those cases if we find that there's not been proper policy established or that the policy's not been followed. We work very closely with the district to provide some support and assistance for them to make corrective actions. And then finally, the Every Student Succeeds Act, the federal ESSA law that replaced No Child Left Behind, requires schools to establish policies that will reduce bullying and harassment, and particularly reduce bullying and harassment incidences of discipline and disproportionate outcomes. And so the center has become a resource for districts that receive federal funds and are required to adhere to that law to put those plans in place. So I'm happy to answer questions, Mr. Chair and committee members, if you have any, but we just are very supportive of continuing this work because it has become a vital resource in our overall school support efforts.
At this point, I think we only have two testifiers, so if the committee, any members, would like to ask questions of this witness, let's go ahead and do that right now.
Actually, the other testifier doesn't appear to be here, so I think the testimony is complete. Mr. Chair. Oh, hey, there you are. Okay, I'm sorry. My mistake. So, yeah, why don't you come on up?
Any other members have questions while she's coming forward? Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Seeing you.
All right. Good morning. My name is Kat Salonik, and I work with Outfront Minnesota, the state's largest LGBTQ advocacy organization. The School Safety Technical Center was created to ensure that there is support, training, and technical assistance for school staff, school boards, and parents and students. The center can provide support for our schools working to address issues around bullying, intimidation, and harassment. Our stake in this is that LGBTQ youth are bullied and harassed at much higher rates. The most recent Minnesota student survey found that LGBTQ youth are 3 times more likely to feel unsafe at school and 4 times more likely to be bullied than their non-LGBTQ peers. LGBTQ youth have higher percentage of suicidal ideation and attempts than their non-LGBTQ student peers. In fact, they are 5 times more likely to attempt suicide than the other students. The part that is hard to look at in this research, in the student survey, is that LGBTQ youth don't feel that they have an adult that they feel safe speaking to at home or at school. The center assists schools who don't have the resources, especially those who don't have the resources, to better prevent the bullying that leads to this suicidal ideation and intimidation to speak to an adult in their community. So I encourage you to vote in favor of ending the sunset policy so that we don't sunset on the schools that need this assistance.
Thank you. Members, do you have any questions for our testifier? Okay. If not, then excuse. Thank you for your testimony. Representative Freiberg, any comments? Are there any members of the audience that are here that would like to testify on this bill? I don't see anybody. Do you want to go ahead and finish up your presentation?
Sure. Thank you, members of the committee.
Oh. Maybe there's
question?
Somebody else that had a question? Representative Paul.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to the author. It might be good for the committee to see the schools that are, because it's commented that certain schools are getting aid and they need aid. It'd be nice to understand those schools and the, maybe the quantities and the type, and so we can understand maybe some members have some districts within or some schools in their districts that are getting this, and I think being better informed and understanding might be useful.
Mr. Chair, Representative Kwong, we'd be happy to provide you with a list of districts that have received support. What I can tell you is that we often do our trainings in Greater Minnesota. So, for instance, we did some training around data analysis and how to better meet the needs of kids, and so that we're not experiencing episodes of disproportionality and suspensions and expulsions. So really looking at restorative practices up front and climate issues. We do training. We did one in Crystal, one in Cloquet, and one in Bemidji. So we're also taking our training out into Greater Minnesota, but we'd be happy to provide you after committee. I can work with staff to get you a list of schools that have been to the entire committee.
Representative Plum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was thinking of the committee as a whole.
Absolutely. Mr. Chair, Representative, absolutely. We'll provide that to your committee to disseminate.
Any other questions? Sorry. I'm not seeing very well, apparently. Representative Thiel.
That's okay. Tice.
I'm sorry, Tice.
My twin sister, yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Chair Freiberg, I just have a couple questions. What happens with the funding? Does that just stop? Originally, it was appropriated a $500,000. Does that appropriation stop?
Mr. Chair, Representative Tice, thanks for the question. I know this is going to go eventually to the Education Finance Committee as well, so that, you know, they will determine the amount of funding. I don't know if Ms. Briner has additional comments on that.
Mr. Chair, Representative Tice, originally the center was funded through a rider. That rider ends and goes on to the bottom line of the department's appropriation under current law.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. Chair Freiberg, I guess, and I missed it, so where is this bill going next?
I think, go ahead, Representative Freiberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Tice. It's going to the Education Policy Committee next.
Okay, thank you.
Representative?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Curious, and I wasn't here when this passed, but a lot of times what I've seen in bills is some type of reporting that's done. In other words, we have a new entity here that's doing something, and it says it will report back to so-and-so or so-and-so at some time specific. I don't see it in this part. I'm just curious how, if that's being done, or just, you know, so that the effectiveness can be evaluated by some type of report back to the legislature.
Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, Representative, there's not a required legislative report, but we do track effort and hours, and that's why I was able to cite some of the statistics about the trainings we provided, the schools we've worked with, the number of investigations and whatnot.
Mr. Chair.
Yep, go ahead.
You know, just a suggestion as this thing moves through, it's good to report what's being done, but I think what's more important sometimes, especially for legislatures, is to report on the outcomes. So depending on what the report says or what might be included in this legislation as it moves through, is some type of a report on the outcomes. What has it actually accomplished, since it appears that it might be going on beyond the sunset that was established when it was enacted?
Representative Freiberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Vogel. Yes, that's a good suggestion. I'd be happy to look into that as this moves forward, and particular in the Education Policy Committee, it seems like a good issue to discuss.
Representative.
Mr. Chair, I just would like to request a roll call on this.
There will be a roll call. Any other questions? Okay, Representative Freiberg, will you put the final motion on the table?
Sure. Once again, thank you, members of the committee, for your consideration of this bill. I think both the center and the council have done important work. The issue of bullying has not gone away, so I think they're as needed as ever, and I appreciate your support, and I will renew my motion that House File 1026 be re-referred to the Committee on Education Policy.
Okay. We'll do the roll call then.
All right.
Representative Freiberg?
Yes.
Representative Bonner?
Yes.
Representative Elkins?
Yes.
Representative Gomez?
Yes.
Representative Cagle?
Yes.
Representative Lee? Representative Lilly?
Yes.
Representative Mason?
Yes.
Representative Pawlowski? Representative Sauk?
Yes.
Representative Nelson?
Yes.
Representative Zerwas? Representative Heinrich?
Yes.
Representative Lehman?
Yes.
Representative Nash? Representative Quam?
Yes.
Representative Tice?
Yes.
Representative Vogel?
Yes.
Representative West?
Yes.
So the votes are 15 aye and 0 no.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee.
The bill will be forwarded to education policy.
The next bill on the agenda is House File 40. Representative Dean, if you could please come forward. This bill has already been heard in the Elections Subcommittee, and there was significant testimony there on this bill. So I've asked to keep testimony limited. I'd like to just not be in the habit of sort of repeating testimony when it's already been hashed out in the Subcommittee. But if there is anybody who did not get an opportunity to speak in the testimony or has additional information, I'd certainly be glad to certainly welcome that sort of information. But Representative Dean, if you could please present your bill.
Thank you, Chair Freiberg. I have a few testifiers. Sure. I've recommended that they be brief, sure. As I'm sure you have other bills to get to. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, and members of the public, my name is Raymond Dean. I'm a state representative, and as a young adult, I was convicted of a felony burglary. Today, I bring before this committee House File 40, a bill related to the restoration of voting rights for those who have been convicted of felony offenses and are no longer locked up in correctional facilities, or for those who have never spent a day inside a correctional facility. And Mr. Chair, if you could have someone move my bill actually before the committee, that would be great.
That would be a great idea, Representative Dean. And I would like to move House File 40 be recommended to pass and re-refer to the Ways and Means Committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And can we also make a caveat on that it should go to public safety after that?
It's noted. It's not at the discretion of Great. The Ways and Means Chair.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So this bill is similar to a bill that was introduced in 2002 by then State Representative Keith Ellison, who is now our Attorney General. Over the last 17 years, it has gained greater and greater bipartisan support. And just in the recent session, it was actually the Republican chair of public safety was the chief author of this bill. HF 40, again, has several Republican co-authors, and it's time for Minnesota to pass this bill. Currently, roughly 62,000 people in Minnesota are under some type of felony supervision, either locked up in one of our several correction facilities, or they are one of the roughly 52,000 Minnesotans who are out in the community doing all that they can to lead their best lives. This bill would allow those convicted of a felony level offense who are no longer locked up or have never been incarcerated to vote. Minnesota would join 14 other states along with District of Columbia, and while we would join states like Oregon, Illinois, Massachusetts, we also would be joining states like Ohio, Utah, and our neighbors to the northwest, North Dakota. It's time for Minnesota to join these states, and I'm going to end my testimony there and turn it over to Secretary of State Steve Simon.
Welcome to the committee, Secretary Simon. If you could just identify yourself for the record, even though most of us know who you are,
sure.
And proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Steve Simon, Minnesota Secretary of State. Thanks for your time and attention. As Secretary of State, I sometimes like to say I'm in the democracy business, and redemption is good for business. Today in Minnesota, as you heard, we have over 50,000 people who would otherwise be eligible to vote but who are ineligible because they have a felony conviction. They've done their time. They're putting their lives back together. They're working. They're paying taxes, and yet they have not had their civil rights restored. We should want people who have left prison, who are doing everything that we're asking them to do, who have left all that behind, we should want them to feel invested. We should want them to feel a sense of ownership, a sense of agency, a sense of control over who governs them and how. And restoring the right to vote at the end of a prison term would also give real opportunities to those who have left prison behind to become full members of their communities and society. It will also set an example for children. You know, there are a lot of studies out there that show that kids are more likely to grow up to be voters if they live in a household of voters. And so we may right now be unintentionally disenfranchising the next generation when we say that their parents, who have left prison behind, who are doing everything that we ask them to do, cannot vote under the law. And this just isn't good for the ex-offender. It's good for all of us in this room and all of us in Minnesota, because we don't want the people who have left prison behind to take a wrong term, go down the wrong path, and reoffend again and end up back in prison. We shouldn't want that, and I know we don't want that. So as you heard from Representative Dean, this is not a DFL idea or a GOP idea. It is increasingly bipartisan. Just look at what happened in Florida this last election. Now, this is a state that is 50-50. They had a recount in their governor's race. They had a recount in their U.S. Senate race. All right? You're getting the picture here. But they had a ballot question about restoring the right to vote for those who have left prison behind, and it passed with 61%. That's a landslide. So even in Florida, where they can't agree on much politically, they agree strongly on this. It has growing bipartisan support. One other historical note that I think is worth talking about. When this law, which has been with us since statehood, went on the books in our Constitution, in the 1860s, for example, there were only a small couple of handfuls or so of felonies on the books. There was no such thing as probation. There was no such thing as supervised release and a small, contained, narrow set of felonies. Now we have hundreds of felonies on the books, and we live in a world that the framers of our Minnesota Constitution could not have imagined. So we have 50,000 people who are in this unfortunate situation, and that number doesn't even reflect the number of people who are confused the other way. I like to point this out, that the confusion goes both ways. For every person that there is, and there are tragically a handful or two every cycle, who believe wrongly that they have had their civil rights restored and they do the wrong thing and they register unlawfully or vote unlawfully, there are a small number, it happens every cycle. For every one of those, there are several whose confusion goes the other way. When I was in the House, alongside many of you, I would door knock a lot, like many of you do, and every single election cycle, without fail, without exception, in Hopkins and St. Louis Park, where I represented, I would knock on someone's door, hand them the lit piece, they'd look me up and down, they'd look the lit piece up and down, they'd say something like, hey, sounds great. You would have my support, you would have my vote if I could vote, but I can't. Sorry. And I'd say, what do you mean? Why can't you vote? And they'd say, well, 20 years ago I committed a felony. And I'd say, oh, are you still on paper? Are you still on probation? Are you still on supervised release? Is that why you can't vote? And they'd say, well, no, I'm off paper. I've been off paper for 10 years, but I committed a felony 20 years ago, so I can't vote, right? And I'd say, no, that's wrong. You've had the right to vote for the last 10 years. The rule in Minnesota is you get your rights restored after the entire sentence is done, both the prison part and the on-paper part. And they didn't know it. So the confusion goes both ways. Tragically, those who believe wrongly that their civil rights have been restored, and then there's a whole swath of people, at least in my former district, that believed they couldn't vote when they could. So the advantage here, one advantage here, is it's administratively very easy. It's a bright-line rule. If someone approaches an election worker in a polling place, and they're otherwise eligible, they're 18 years old, they're a citizen, they're a resident, etc., unless they're an escapee, you know that the person in front of you is eligible to vote. So administratively, it makes a lot of sense. The current law, I think, is outdated. It's archaic. It does not reflect our current Minnesota values, and I think the time is now for Minnesota to join the growing number of states. You heard North Dakota, Iowa's moving in that direction, Florida, and others, who are making sure that those who have left prison behind have a chance to be in the circle again and to be part of our democracy. Thank you.
Thank you, Secretary Simon. Representative Quam, I think, before you leave, has a question.
Yeah.
First, I want clarification from staff. My understanding is that recently, 13, 14, or around that time period, a informational statute was done so that when a felon finishes their sentencing, then, or what we're, I believe, maybe even the Secretary of State's office is involved in informing them. Is that correct?
Mr. Garing? Or Secretary's? They're both pointing at each other. Mr. Garing.
Mr. Chair, Representative Quam, in this bill, there is a new requirement that the Secretary of State provide a publication that relates to voting rights. And I believe in, I forget if it was 12 or 13, there was a working group convened by the Secretary of State that did prepare some additional materials that I think are used, but the Secretary probably can describe that in more detail. Yeah.
Thank you.
Secretary Simon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Mr. Garing. That's correct. In 2013, we tried, and a good memory, Representative Quam, we did have a bill that actually had no trouble in the House. It did have trouble in the Senate I think it costs like $200,000 or $300,000, which would have automatically done just as I think you're suggesting, which is notify people when their civil rights are restored by letter. Unfortunately, we couldn't get the support in the Senate, but there was bipartisan support for it in the House.
Representative Quam?
Thanks for that refreshing my memory. But, you know, a lot of the terminology of completing their incarceration, I believe the way it's been enforced is completing your sentence. And as a youth and my life, I've noticed that sometimes those that are poor and less powerful actually complete their sentence in incarceration. But the rich that can afford the lawyers, the connected, get the parole, get the home monitoring. And frankly, I would agree that felonies, that's serious, and there are probably some things on the books as felonies that maybe shouldn't be felonies. But that would behoove us as a legislature to fix that. And, some felonies are extremely serious. And frankly, justice would be not rewarding the rich and connected because they get a different type of sentence. And, the poor and less powerful and unconnected who serve their time, this bill would have no effect on. So I like the idea of the informational, and I think we touched on that the House was supportive of that because we do need to let people know your civil rights, civil liberties are fully restored. But I do have issues on the justice point of those that, nothing against public defenders, but those that can't afford a high-dollar lawyer and they spend their time incarcerated for their sentence, they're not equally, their civil rights, again, until the sentence is done, are not restored. And I think that is pretty close to the language of the Constitution. And, I think that I could support part of this, but as a whole, I don't agree that some people, because they got favorable sentencing, get their rights restored before their sentence is complete, and others who weren't as fortunate don't. And I don't see that as equal justice.
Chair Dean, I think, would like to comment on this briefly. I have one other member question, and I would, you know, if we could keep those quick, I would like to just find out if there's other people who would like to testify also.
Yeah, I have a few other testifiers. Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Quam. I think I understand what you're saying, and we know that all of the individuals that are out in public, we expect to lead their best lives possible. We expect them to have jobs. We expect them to be what some people would say is productive citizens, and that voting is a key component in all of those. Individuals in states that have their voting rights restored are less likely to reoffend. And your point about an unequal justice system, which I think is what you're talking about right now, this would actually make it totally equal. In other words, those that are locked up can't vote, and those that are out in public can vote, as compared to those that are locked up and then get a short period of probation versus those who end up getting long periods of probation. So ultimately, this will actually have the exact impact on the thing that you are saying troubles you about this. So by if someone is wealthy and they get a 20 or 30 year sentence of probation, currently they can't vote under that period. If someone struggles economically, couldn't get that lawyer, they serve a few years, they have possibly a shorter probation period than what was originally there, they would then be able to vote. So I think your intent on trying to create a justice system that's the same for everybody, that's what this does. It creates that bright line. So I would just suggest that, as Secretary Simon mentioned, there are a lot of individuals out there who don't vote because they don't believe they've had that right restored. I can speak from my personal experience. I applied for a pardon from the state of Minnesota because I wanted to vote. I wanted to be a member of society. I wanted to be able to participate on Election Day. And I don't think that we can underestimate that desire. And I've got a few other testifiers that will speak to the importance of that. So I'll end my comments and let you move on to other committee members and then bring down a few other testifiers.
Sure. Representative Mason, quick question before we turn to testimony.
I'd rather hear the testifiers first.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Secretary Simon. If I could have John Hall come on down and give us a couple minutes on why this is important to him. I'll let him introduce himself and speak to his affiliation with Jewish Community Action.
Okay. Welcome to the committee. If you could please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Yeah, my name is John Hall. I'm a member of Jewish Community Action. I haven't just made a lot of mistakes. I've made a lot of bad decisions on purpose, suffered a lot of consequences, did a lot of time in prison, probation, parole. It's odd to speak in this arena because I've traditionally felt like I didn't belong here, like it wasn't mine, like I was, I didn't belong. I had the opportunity to change my life, get involved with Jewish Community Action, get activated in social justice work of various sorts. I also had the opportunity to spend a good part of the year working for the Minneapolis Regional Labor Federation, campaigning for labor-endorsed candidates. I recruited volunteers, I door-knocked, phone banked. I can't even count the number of people that I convinced to go vote. I couldn't even go vote myself. And that hurt. Because in spite of everything I've done and everything I've been through, I love the United States of America. I love the Constitution. I appreciate my second, fifth, and tenth chances. And then I go to my probation officer, and I find out that Lieutenant Michael Folsom from the Minneapolis Police Department is trying to gather information on me and investigate. So I can't even campaign now without coming under the scrutiny of the police. And this hurts because I'm trying. You know, it's like winning the lottery for me to get a job. It's impossible to get an apartment, impossible. And I want to participate. You know, I want to be involved. And that's it. I appreciate it. Thank you.
Yep. Thank you for your testimony, Mr. Hall. Is there anybody else who would like to testify?
I have a couple other.
Okay, sure.
Mr. Chair, if Londell French, if you please come down, and after Londell, I have Donald Crumbly, and then I'll have Judge Small, who is the director of the County Attorneys Association.
Welcome to the committee, Commissioner French. If you could please state your name for the people listening at home and proceed with your testimony.
I am Londell French, Minneapolis Park Commissioner, but I'm also a member of Take Action Minnesota. That's where I got a lot of my political training and startup and being an activist / organizer. I'm here. I want to talk about my cousin, who was more like a brother because I didn't grow up with brothers. My cousin was a high school basketball star in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, had all type of prospects for college, and he wound up doing something stupid, which most, you know, 18, 19-year-olds wound up doing. My cousin wound up serving a couple years in prison. When he got out, nobody wanted for him to play basketball anymore. That dream was done. He couldn't even get a scholarship. I mean, he couldn't even get a student loan because of the felony he had on his record. Couldn't stay with the mother of his children because that place didn't allow certain folks to live in those places. So all his humanity was kind of stripped away a little bit. No, it was stripped away a lot. So he couldn't participate in some of the stuff that I participated in. I grew up in the same type of environment where there's a lot of stupid stuff going on. I got lucky and didn't catch a felony. He got unlucky and got a felony. So after this, all these, you know, the turmoil of getting out of prison, the trauma of dealing with what prison is like, to come on the streets and not be able to find a place to live, to be able to vote and do all the other stuff that people participate in our society, my cousin wound up taking his own life after a few years on the street. And it was like, wow, I didn't get a felony. I know I probably should have been in trouble about some of the stuff that I did. But the fact that I didn't get a felony, he did. And our lives were dramatically different. So I'm a member of the Minneapolis Park Board. The people who came out to vote for folks like me look like me. And a lot more often than that, the folks who are restricted from voting look like me. Since the end of the Civil War, they have been trying to restrict the votes of black and brown folks. And this is a good way for us to change that tie. If you have a kid at a school, and there's a law or rule or something that's going to affect your kid adversely, you can't even go out and campaign for a candidate that's in favor of the stuff for your kid. That is devastating. We need to get a power back to the folks who deserve it, people who came out and served their time and want to participate in our community. So please, please, I urge you guys to pass this this bill, and hopefully we can get our country back on the right track again. All right? Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner French.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And now if I could have Donald Crumbly come down, and I'll let him introduce himself as he's associated with several organizations.
Welcome to the committee, Mr. Crumbly. If you could please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Donald Crumbly. I work with Barbershops Creating Change in the Community through Way of Isaiah. And I was originally born and raised in Chicago, Illinois, on the south side. I've definitely seen the good, bad, and ugly. I moved to Minnesota in 98. My best friend, he was just released from prison some months before I moved, and one of the things that I was trying to do is help him with reentry into society, because there are a lot of layers to that. Unfortunately, through him not being able to get a job, not being able to vote, feeling like he's been stripped of his dignity. He didn't even feel like he was a part of society the way that he was treated. I tried to convince him to move to Minnesota because I saw the opportunity. And he wouldn't hear me because he was going through so much at the time. I got my first apartment that February, and a week later, I get a call that he was murdered through mistaken identity. So what I do now is, ever since that happened, I made it my life's mission to raise my own kids a certain way, to look out for his kids when I can, and to fight so that others don't have to experience that. Everybody makes mistakes. I believe we all have something we wish we could take back or redo. But unfortunately, it doesn't work that way. But you guys have an opportunity to save a lot of lives and restore hope, because hope is the biggest thing. Hope can change so much for so many people. And I just urge you guys, if you know, you could take a second and put yourself in these people's shoes and imagine how you would feel if that occurred, you know, in your life or a loved one's life. So that's my fight. That's one of our initiatives. And I just hope that you guys find it in your heart to consider passing this bill.
Thank you, Mr. Cromley.
And thank you, Mr. Chair. My last testifier is Judge Small, the director for the County Attorney's Association.
Welcome to the committee. If you could please just state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Robert Small, and I am currently the executive director for the Minnesota County Attorneys Association. Our association has long been supporters of prior renditions of the current House File 40, and we continue to support that. And I just wanted everybody to know that the County Attorneys Association supports House File 40. We urge that you pass it to the Ways and Means Committee.
Okay. Thank you, Judge Small. Appreciate your testimony. I also have on our list Brad Leto. Did he want to speak on this? Welcome to the committee. If you could please just identify yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Brad Leto, the Secretary Treasurer of the Minnesota AFL-CIO, and I apologize to the author and committee members that we did not have we had nobody available to testify in the previous committee, so I'll be very brief. You know, the Minnesota AFL-CIO is a federation of over 1,000 local unions and state councils with over 300,000 members, and I am here today to testify in support of House File 40, and I won't go through a lot of the other information that's already been cited. I just want to say that in 2014, over 450 delegates to the Minnesota AFL-CIO convention passed a resolution in support of restoring voting rights to felons completing their prison terms or their incarceration. That has since been reaffirmed by the executive board of the Minnesota AFL-CIO in subsequent years. And we believe it is time to join, as was cited before, other states in the region, including North Dakota, Indiana, Illinois, Ohio, and Michigan. And we do believe that, I mean, people that have served their time are working in society. In fact, I know we have, within unions, people working in society, paying taxes, members of their community, involved in their local community. And they just, as Mr. Hall mentioned, they will work in community events and everything else, but not be able to vote. And that does, I can speak for a number of people I've talked to, that does hurt. So please vote yes on House File 40. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Leto. Is there anybody else who would like to testify to House File 40? Okay, not seeing anybody, so close the public testimony. I have a couple members who are on the list earlier. I think maybe I'll start with them and then go to the ones who've been added. Representative Gomez,
I'm good, but I wanted to do a roll call on this one too, if we can.
Sure.
Thank you.
Roll call has been requested. Representative Mason?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I will be supporting this bill, and it seems to me it's long past due. And I have really strong feelings about this and I've come a long way on this over the years. But what is our expectation of punishment. And I think we need to start talking about this as a state, as a community. I mean, most of us just think, all right, somebody's put in jail, they've served their time, that should be the end of it. When they get out, they should be able to get a job. They should be able to find a place. But the way our system seems to be working, in my perception, is people are being punished forever. And we've heard a couple of comments about that's what's happening. They can't find a place to live. They can't find a job. And the deal is, if we can't find a way for people who have paid their dues, we might as well just have an island send people rather than have them suffer the way that they are doing. So again, I encourage people to vote for this bill. It's something. It's probably not as much as we need to be doing if we truly want people to be functioning people of our community. But it's a start. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Mason. Representative Cagle.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is kind of a subject that I've learned a lot about recently, just because of family ties. And I just received a phone call from my brother yesterday telling me how frustrated he is with the system and how it's completely set up for people to fail. My brother has to pay for his own probation. He has to pay for all sorts of things associated with making a mistake. And I don't know if you know this, Representative Dean, but do you know if people on a stay of adjudication can vote?
Representative Dean?
Mr. Chair, Representative Cagle, I think that that might be a little bit unclear, and what I'll do is have Judge Small come and speak to that.
Okay. Judge Small, welcome back.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, Representative. A stay of adjudication is not a conviction, and so because the prohibition is on convictions, they would be eligible.
Representative Cagle?
Thank you for that. I think that kind of also piggybacks on what Representative Quam was saying about how people who can afford a representation tend to get a better deal. But I think that this is a really good bill, and I appreciate you bringing it forward. So thank you.
Thank you, Representative Cagle. Representative Dean?
Just in response to that, Mr. Chair and Representative, I think that that's one of the things that there's a lot of confusion out there, and this is one of the things that if you're locked up, you can't vote if you're locked up for a felony. If you're out in public, you can vote. So no one's going to be saying, so you got a stay of adjudication. It's something that's really actually makes it a lot easier for election judges and lots of other things. But I'll leave some of this to my later statements.
Okay. Representative Tice.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Dean, I struggle with this constantly. As business owners, we have hired folks that have had felonies. In fact, some of them we would pick them up and bring them to work and then take them back again. And same with renting as well. I struggle with it. I see what they're going through. But on the other hand, I'm also, you know, a sentence includes parole. And I think we do a better justice if we look at the public safety side of it and what we're doing, what we're saying, this is your sentence, and what does parole mean, and how long is it? And as Representative Quam said too, you know, if you got the money to afford it, you get a longer parole. Well, that doesn't seem fair. So I think, for me, I would feel better if we would do better on the public safety side when we have the sentencing guidelines. What does this mean and what does that mean, and take care of it. I don't agree with some of the sentences that include a really long parole. I think that's goofy. I don't know why we do it. You know, it doesn't make sense to me, because I probably would say more, you know, a sentence is a sentence, and once it's done, you're done. But and so I'm conflicted with that, because I wish we would do more work on that side of it and do more with the sentencing guidelines. I feel like we're only putting a Band-Aid on it because we have other issues with it. So Thanks for bringing the bill forward. I truly don't know how I'm going to vote. I really don't. I'm so conflicted on this one. But thank you for doing it. But I think we need to hit public, we need to hit the sentencing guidelines a lot. I think there's a lot of work to be done on that. And thank you. Thank you for your work.
Mr. Chair and Representative Tice, I hear what you're saying. Public safety is always my number one concern. If evidence didn't show and if I didn't believe that this actually would help with public safety, I may not be introducing this bill. I truly believe that when individuals feel like they're a part of their community, and believe me, every election day, that Tuesday in November, anybody who can't vote because of a felony record kind of walks around feeling like they're not part of the community. So pro-social behavior, which is what voting is actually going to be better for public safety in the long run. You know, we can talk about all the complications, and in public safety we're looking at issues around lengths of probation and all those other things. But again, this is something that's been around 17 years. It's moved from kind of a partisan issue to a real bipartisan issue. Not 100%, don't get me wrong. I certainly understand that there's still some concerns about it. The bright line is really, really important. You know, this is supported by groups like the League of Minnesota Cities, you know, the Association of Minnesota Counties. This has broad support across the whole state, and I just think it's time we pass this.
Thank you, Chair Dean. Did you have a follow-up, Representative Tice? Okay. Representative Zerwas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to Representative Dean, thanks for carrying this bill. Again, I'm proud to be your number two co-author on this bill and have worked on this bill, I think, every year since we first roomed together in freshman orientation. My roomie. So you might know me as kind of a law and order state representative. But this issue, I think, to me is very clear and cut. The idea that the moment someone is released from prison back into the community, we request and expect that they start participating in civic engagement, and they find a place to live, and they get a job, and they become contributing members of society. And for whatever reason, the state of Minnesota, we've implemented a sentencing scheme that includes about nearly four decades of probation for some offenders on the back end, and we have thousands and thousands of convicted felons that will never ever ever step one foot or spend one day in a prison, but will spend 20 or 30 years on monitoring through probation. And so for folks on my side that have concerns with ridiculous probation lengths, we have a bill for that. We have a bill to cap probation at 5 years. I think the latest study that we saw says that 95% of individuals that reoffend within the first 24 or 36 months. And from there, it drops off precipitously. At 5 years to 25 years, it's nominal. And we're spending millions and millions of dollars to monitor people that are just, in many, 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 many instances, are just not a threat. If you haven't taken care of your substance abuse issues, if you haven't taken care of your underlying criminal issues during your first five years of probation, you're going to have another encounter with law enforcement. You're going to violate the terms of your release, and you're going to be back introduced into the system. If you've made it 5, 7, 10, 15, 20, 25 years, and now you have a senior in high school and you have a 12-year-old at home, and there is a voter referendum for their school. And don't get me wrong, we want you to get a job, we want you to get a house, we want you to pay your property taxes, but we don't want you to vote in that referendum. That's garbage. That's absolute garbage. If we expect individuals to be a part of our society, and we have every expectation for them to be a part of our society, we need to let them participate in our society. That's what this bill is about. I understand that some folks still see it as a political issue. There are four or five GOP co-authors on your bill, Mr. Chair.
Representative Zerwas, I believe that there's five. I talked to many, many members on your side about signing on, and some said, well, I'm not sure I'm ready, I might support it when it comes to voting, but, they weren't in that place. And I think that that's one of the great things about this place, if there is a great thing about this place, is we get to have discussions, we get to have dialogues, we get to talk about these issues. And that's an important thing of what we do here. There are a few people that came up and testified, not just about their own personal plight, but loved ones. And, I often think, when I think about this bill and my sort of voraciousness on trying to get this through, is it a little too personal for me? I can't stress enough how important that sense of feeling like I vote. I remember vividly the first time I got my voting rights restored, and that voting, that was really, really a precious time. So, Representative Zerwas, you and I may not always agree on everything, but we do agree on a lot, and I want to thank you for your comments, and I want to thank you, Mr. Chair, for the hearing today, and I just encourage all members to support this bill.
Thank you, Chair Dean. Representative Zerwas, did you have a follow-up?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, no, that's all. That's all I had. I actually have to hustle and be a part of Disability Day at the Capitol in the Rotunda. My request is, and I don't know if Representative Gomez would be willing, but I don't view this as a political issue, and so my hope is that you'll remove the roll call and we can move this bill forward.
I did have Representative Gomez on my list next. Is that what this was related to, Representative Gomez?
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Yeah, I would like to withdraw my request for a roll call on this. I didn't know that asking for a roll call really was like trying to make it political, to be honest. And I like to take votes that way, but I get it. So thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you both. Representative Lee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and before Representative Zerwas leave, I just want to say thank you to Representative Zerwas, Chair Dean, and Chair Feiberg for allowing us to even have this conversation. And I do know that, this bill has, touched different parts of, for me personally, having worked as an election administrator for the city of Minneapolis, having worked for Secretary Simon, and, as a community organizer. And it's the same story that Secretary Simon have shared, where we were just getting out there connecting with people to talk about what really matters for them in our communities and to really see what we can do to just get them to get out there and exercise the right to vote. And at the end of the conversation, a lot of the conversation ends up with, I can't really participate because of my past, because of my felony record. And I know that, this means a lot to a lot of our constituents, representing our part of the city of Minneapolis. And so I just want to say thank you for bringing this forward. And I really hope that this is the year that we can actually get this to go all the way. And thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Lee.
Mr. Chair, I just want to add one thing. We've talked a lot about the inner city in Minneapolis. 65% of the people whose votes will be restored live outside of Minneapolis and St. Paul.
So this isn't just a Minneapolis and St. Paul issue. This is an issue that affects people throughout the state of Minnesota.
Okay. Thank you, Chair Dean. I don't have any other members on the list. Are there any other questions or comments? Okay. Then I will renew my motion that House File 40 be re-referred to the Ways and Means Committee. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
Motion carries.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Dean. So I think that's all the business we have here today. Thank you, committee members. I will see you again on Thursday. This meeting is adjourned.